Okay, good. You're hired.
Thank you.
Start some afternoon, can't you? You mind working nights and weekends?
Not at all, not at all. I used to work in radio. I was loved it. I was worked in the cultural affairs department of an NPR station in Boston. Some years ago, and feels like home. It feels great.
You produced culture?
Well, I tried my best. I mostly just sat in the booth and engineered the sessions with the interviews and stuff like that. So
kind of like a producer, I guess.
I guess so. I mean, I was just a kid.
What do you mean, just a kid?
I was in college at the time. It was an internship. Yeah. You know? So I guess I was a producer, but I mean, it sort of didn't feel like
this was a college station. Huh?
That's right. Well, it was connected. WBUR has an affiliation with Boston University, but it actually is an independent entity. You know, I'm not sure how NPR actually even works, but it had its independence, but was able to draw off students for, you know, the old slice and dice editing and all that sort of thing.
What did you study? You had Boston U, right?
Boston U. Yeah, I'm English, and then I ran away. I dropped out because I got a job with a publisher in Boston. David Godin, a small company down there.
A well-known one, too.
Yeah.
Found in his own imprint.
Found in his own imprint, exactly. Well, yeah,
You formed your own imprint?
Yeah, David was doing kids' books, some kids' books, and some adult books. And then David is loopy enough in a sort of wonderful way, sort of loose enough as a manager, that if you have an idea as an employee, he's able to give you the, you can go with it. So he let me have my own imprint to do paperbacks. Kids mm-hmm. use paperbacks. And that was...
For a children's book.
That's right. That's right. About 10 years ago now.
Well, I've talked to some editors who have their own imprints. They say often they get an imprint in lieu of a raise.
It's happening a lot more now. A lot of editors are getting their own imprints more and more. I mean, it's... Some insiders say it's becoming pretty meaningless. There were a number of new announcements recently about new imprints that were forming. And somebody remarked, gee, I thought you had to be an editor before you could get your own imprint. But these days it's pretty easy, actually. It's just getting to mean a lot less. You know, maybe that's part of it, rather than maybe it's trade off with promotion. But,
that must be a good feeling, though, in these bigger publishing houses to have some autonomy in the middle of a large operation like that.
If that's what it means, and often it unfortunately doesn't.
Well, having your own imprint, doesn't that mean you don't have to clear the books that you publish?
Usually it does, but you're still reporting into a publisher, and you're still responsible for, reporting in and having the publisher make sense of the entire balance of the list. I mean, often it does, but I think that often these days it's often just set up to give somebody some recognition and maybe a movable raise, actually. So it there isn't quite the autonomy that everybody might like.
Mm.
From what I understand, this is just, you know, gossip on some level, just hearing people who have their own imprints now and what they're saying about it.
So you go way back with regard to children's books, huh?
Yeah.
You can't go too far back when you're still a young guy.
I guess so. Mm-hmm. I guess so, yeah, 10 years. Mm-hmm. 10 years. It took me a while to find Book of the Month, which I'm glad I finally did, you know, because with Godin, being part of a small company means that you can do everything, you know, everything, any job that you want to do, evenings, weekends, whatever, you're welcome to it. And I was doing library services, I was doing publicity promotion, I was editing books, I was doing accounts receivable. I mean, I did practically every job that you can do in a publishing company. And that was a great training, a great background to have, you know. And the Book of the Month offers you a chance, as an editor, offers you a chance to be involved in marketing, publicity, promotion, you know, the catalogs that we do that we send out to members.
Well, let's talk about
sure.
Book of the Month. This is part of the Book of the Month Club.
It is. It is part of the Book of the Month.
And the Children's Book of the Month Club is a relatively new entry, I guess, about a year or so old?
That's right, about a year and a half.
What was the thinking in creating this division of the Book of the Month Club?
Well, the main thinking is that there are an awful lot of people who want books for their children and see the value in that. And that interest is best served by a club that's devoted to children's books. Children's books are complicated because you have children developing at different rates, you have different reading levels, you have books appealing to different types of parents, and it's very hard to cover that interest within one general interest club. What we are able to do is offer a vast array of selection, books for babies, books for preschoolers, books for kids in elementary school, books for kids in the upper reaches of elementary school, practically all the way up into junior high school, in one club. And we can service those members every 3.5 weeks to get another catalog with just a tremendous range of selections. And that can't be served under a general interest club.
Now, does the Children's Book of the Month Club operate autonomously within Book of the Month?
Yes, it does.
In other words, you don't share catalogs.
No, we do not. Well, there is some cross, Book of the Month will offer children's titles within their own news, and we work together on those types of things. And we also set up catalogs for them, for their members. We will do a children's catalog 3 or 4 times a year, great holiday books, great books for summer, great books for spring. And Book of the Month will mail that catalog out to their members. So there is cooperation. It's autonomous in the sense of being a different division, but we do work a lot together.
Now, is it structured the same way in terms of reaching an audience?
It's structured the same way in terms of reaching the audience. It's structured differently internally in that, for one thing, we don't have any panel of judges. It's just me. And
you're a child at heart. Like, you have to be a child at heart to do it.
You really do. I mean, because there's a lot of business involved. There's a lot of decision making that you have to do. But the end of the process is a child sitting down with a book, and that is the image you have to keep in mind. And you have to really want to make books part of a child's life to really grow and thrive in this business as a business. And it's very important. You have to stay in touch with what your business is on an adult level. I mean, I did adult book work. I was an editor for a bit doing adult novels and stuff like that. And it's just a very different way of looking at books and different type of marketing. And kids' books were really much more for me.
Mm-hmm. Now the catalogs go out on a monthly basis to those on your list.
That's right.
In the same way that the Book of the Month Club catalogs go out.
Oh, absolutely.
And you reach them, I presume, mostly by direct mail.
Well, direct mail and telemarketing is a very important part. And through some print ads, not too many. It's hard to reach a very narrow audience, which is a parent who wants books for their children and is the right age and all of that. It's a lot of direct mail. And that's a big part of the mix, certainly. And then also through cross-club promotions into members of other clubs, asking them if they want to join our club.
How many members do you have?
Right now, about 150,000, and that's after a year and a half, which is really quite an incredible number to have achieved after that length of time. That's just the start. We're growing really rapidly, and in a couple of years, we could really go through the roof in terms of membership.
Are there other children's book clubs in competition with you?
There are. Most of the clubs are under under a particular license arrangement. And in the case where you have a club that is a Dr. Seuss book club or a Sesame Street book club or a Disney book club where they're offering one type of book, what we can offer is the range of selection from within all of that. We do offer Disney titles and Sesame Street titles, mm-hmm. but we are offering a broad selection of the best that's just published and the best of the past as well. So there is a lot of competition, and it's good more competition. The children's market for books is just incredible. It's booming. And our business is booming, and people will get more and more competition as time goes on.
Well, what about your age range?
That is something that we're going to be expanding next year, actually. If we can go from babies all the way up to high school, ultimately, we've really covered that, and then those members, if they're happy, we can promote up into QPB and Book of the Month and keep them forever, which would be a great thing to be able to do, theoretically. I'm not sure that would actually happen or not, but still, the idea of being able to sell older books, older novels, YA novels, to preteens and teens is something that we very much are going to do, and we're going to start that next year.
So currently, what is your age range?
Ranges from 0, which means babies, all the way up, to 10-year-olds and some 12-year-olds.
So you don't really do young adult books at this time?
We offer some. Because I think that it's important for us to offer as much selection as we can, and we do get people buying books as gifts for other children or for older brothers and sisters in the same household. So we offer some on occasion, and probably 1 or 2 books every month would be for for young adults.
Now, are you offering primarily new children's books, or do you also have a list of staples?
Well, there's a pretty good mix. I think about half of what we offer, or more, is new, just published, the books that should be the best of the books coming out. We spend a great deal of time looking at each book that's published and sifting through them, thousands of books every year that are coming in. The advantage of the children's business is being able to also offer the books from the past that parents still want. Our best-selling title of the year by far is a book called Where the Wild Things Are, which was first published in 1963. And that, for us, is sold as well, in fact, better than most new books that we've offered.
It's the famous Marie Sendak book.
Yes, indeed.
Do publishing houses send you their new books? Is that how you make your selection, or do you go out and solicit these new books?
A little bit of both. The publishers that are oriented towards selling books to book clubs, and not all of them are, will come and see us, show us their books, and we'll look through them, we'll read them, we read everything that comes in. As I say, it's about 1,000, it can even be more than that a year. So it's a lot of books to look through that come in. There are also publishers that aren't so aggressive, and there are books on publishers' backlist that we know we want to have. Maybe we missed them the first time around, or books that have gotten been well received, are getting good reviews. So we will also aggressively go after those books as well. So we react to stuff coming in, and then we also go out and get the stuff we need, so that each catalog we send out is filled with as much variety and choice as we can give.
Well, it looks like there's a great deal of subject matter here. I guess you don't exclude anything, right? Is that right? I
mean,
an open mind.
We're very open minded. I think that's the service that we offer. We're closed minded when it comes to books that we don't feel off. We're closed minded about books that are not of the highest quality according to our standards. And I hope that our standards are standards which others will agree are correct, are right. Because we're very concerned about the books matching the interest level of the children. We're very concerned about books that won't offend the membership, books that teach good values. But mostly, above all, books that will engage a child's attention, books that will give them that wonderful initiation into the world of reading. That's the primary thing. There is a lot of stuff published every year, and unfortunately, a lot of it is not of the highest quality, and that's one thing that we provide in looking through the books. Other than that, we're very open-minded, because mm-hmm. I think that most parents want their children to have a variety of experiences. So I'm not exclusive about even movie tie-ins or whatever else that I feel really are very good at what they are. And then the parent can choose whether they want to have their child exposed to various types of books within a broad range. And that's really my job.
Would you exclude Judy Blume?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, I think that she's a very, very good writer, actually. I think that she does a very good job of doing what she does.
Well, she's the most controversial of the young adult writers whose books have been banned in the Bible Belt for years.
That's right. We don't actually, I must say, offer the books that are her more controversial YA books. The books that we offer are her younger books for 8 to 12-year-olds, as a rule. We have offered a few. But our club does provide choice in the sense that we try to make it very clear to parents what the book is about in our catalogs. And we will tell them that a book is controversial or touches on these matters. The books are banned in some areas. On the other hand, a lot of parents find them to be of value. So it's our job to provide the books, to be sensitive about people's concerns, to share with the parents what those issues are, and finally the choice is theirs.
Do you rebind the books in the process, create your own editions?
No, that's one of the unique things about our club, actually, is that we offer publisher's editions, so that the books we sell in our club are the same editions that you would be able to buy in a bookstore. Most book clubs don't do that. I can't generally say that I think it's a good idea for people to join book clubs as a general, broad, sweeping statement. I think that often that people aren't being offered the best value in books that have been rebound and are printed on toilet paper and all of that. I think that we maintain a very high level of standards, the same set by the parent company in offering publishers on editions, which is another reason why our club offers, I feel, just tremendous value to the members. Because if I'm offering you the same book you can go into a bookstore and buy, and I'm offering you 40% off the published price, I think I'm giving you a good deal.
Well, it sounds like a good deal, but many of these large bookstores offer vast discounts as well. Is there any price advantage, cost advantage to subscribing to the Children's Book of the Month Club or going to, say, Barnes & Noble and buying the same book?
The Barnes & Noble type store are discounting, as a rule, bestsellers. We extend that discount across the line. We often offer discounts even higher than 40% on new books as well. So you find the selected titles, the ones that we've judged to be of the highest standards, at the high discount. We're not just reacting to bestsellers. There are a lot of books that are bestsellers that for kids as well, that we've excluded for reasons that we just feel that they aren't of the to our standards. So whatever titles are here have been pre-selected, and the discounts apply. So there's a few things at work here. But I guess the major thing is that our titles, we don't just discount bestsellers. We discount bestsellers and classics and backlist books.
Well, what would be an average price range for your children's books? I guess it's hard to tell because so many of them are picture books and then others are rather dense, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. But I think an average price would certainly be about $13. Now, that's often a price that would also include more than one book. I mean, our selections are often made up of four books that go together, or three books that go together, sometimes two books that go together, and selling them for that price. But $12, $13 is about average.
There are so many bookstores in the malls today. 20, 30 years ago, it was harder to find a bookstore. Do these proliferation of bookstores mean greater degree of competition for the book clubs?
It does, but I don't think it's hurt at all. My philosophy is always that a rising tide lifts all boats. If a publisher is promoting a book through a bookstore and getting a lot of attention for it, that ends up helping us. The books that we sell the best are the books that are being promoted in bookstores just as aggressively as we're promoting them in our club. I just don't think that we live in such a small world that we have to worry about every bit of competition. If we do our job and we offer the members the best books at the best values, we can't lose, and that's why our business is strong. And I think that the bookstores, our customers certainly go into bookstores and buy books from them as well. I mean, we are a primary source for our members for children's books, but we're not the only source, and we don't consider ourselves to be the only source. So I think that the bookstores that are out there that are good book, and there's a lot of good bookstores out there, do provide a good service. You can't say, though, that mall stores in small towns always have, you know, wonderful bookstores. You can find Where's Waldo and Ninja Turtles, and often that's just about it. Maybe a few Dr. Seuss or something.
These mall stores tend to carry the same books.
That's right. That's right. And the children's section are often the least attended of any section in the store. The clerks there generally do not know children's books, and that's a pretty broad statement. There's a lot of great retailers out there, but you can't often get the help you need as a parent to find the right book for your child. So there's a service element that's very important that's missing in a lot of these types of stores.
Yeah, when the parent gets the monthly catalog, the books are pre-screened, and there's some endorsement here. It's not like buying blindly, is it?
That's right, that's right. And we hope that by showing the parent the book itself, we show them the cover and the inside spreads where we can, and by writing copy about each book descriptively, and talking about what is in each book, that the member will have a very, very clear idea of what the book is and deciding it's right for their child before they make the purchase.
Well, there's something kind of nice about ordering by mail. Anyway, I'm a computer buff, and while I love to go to places like software, et cetera, I love to get computer catalogs and order by mail for $3 if you order by 3 o'clock. It usually arrives before noon the next day. You know, you don't have to pay the New York sales tax. You know, and it's usually discounted because it comes from mail.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's something kind of nice about that, too. And it must be also good for people who live in more rural areas.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, what's funny, too, is that urban areas, I mean, I feel the same way. I mean, I ordered videos from mail order catalogs that I get, which seems ridiculous. I'm living in New York City. But, you know, it's so convenient, and often it's the savings thing, too.
Just get up a little closer.
Oh, sorry. Traveling. It's often the convenience of it and the savings that you can get. And if I'm getting something in the mail and I open up and see something I want, I just go ahead and get it. I mean, I just don't want to spend the time to run around trying to, find it at Barnes & Noble, wherever else, you know, video shops and all of that. But anyway.
I don't suppose it's possible to spot any kind of trends in children's literature, is there?
Yes, there is. I think that there are fortunate and unfortunate trends. I think the unfortunate trends are that the illustrators today have become the king of the children's book industry. In that 30, 40 years ago, there were writers who wrote picture books especially and did that for a living, people like Margaret Wise Brown, and illustrators were there to serve the written word. And as time has gone on with today, especially with the chain stores and all of the whole retail market opened up, there's a much greater stress paid on the graphics of a book. It's the first thing anybody sees. They open it up and they see terrific graphics and they think right away, this is going to be a wonderful book. And often, though, the illustrators of today just don't have the narrative sense that existed 20, 30 years ago by the best illustrators of the previous generation. So that often the word is not being served in the way that it should, in my view. We tend to offer a lot of classics partly because that sense of narrative, which I think is so important, is often missing in books today. I think that's a very definite and disturbing trend. On the other hand, there are a lot of really good books being published, so my view of it tends to be of the broad spectrum of what I see. Our members don't see all the things that I've seen and said no to. So that there's a lot of good stuff being published, and I think that you can say that certainly that there are enough good things coming out that to a person, an average consumer, they might not be able to actually see the difference. But the other, actually, and it's a big shift, is just that the change in morals and changes in values, what today is regarded as immoral. If you want to say that issues such as sexism, racism, that parents are concerned about, there are books, great classics that are published that are racist, that are sexist, that don't teach, don't inspire the kinds of values that parents want their children to have. I mean, Babar the Elephant is a colonialist, you know?
I would doubt the Little Black Sambo would make your list.
No. Exactly. So, I mean, there are...
So you're saying that the themes are different. They're more direct and honest about the problems that we have in the 1990s.
Yes, yes, it's true. And I think that the children's books are a very quick way of judging the overall society, because children's books do tend to reflect the values of the society. And I think that what we're seeing now is a great interest in multicultural experiences. I mean, if consciousness in the awakening consciousness of a child is the response to the total environment that they're living in, giving that child multicultural books that show people of other races, of other nations, can help open them up to what that total environment really means. And I think parents are more aware of that today than ever before.
Did you read Alison Lurie's book about diversity of children's literature?
The Don't Tell the Grown-Ups, or
yes.
The... Yes.
Don't Tell the Grown-Ups.
And the Gretchen... I'm recalling the title. Yes, she's a wonderful writer.
Well, her thesis, as you recall then, is that the books that she hated as a kid were what she called the goody-goody books. These were usually books that made adults a primary in a children's life, and that the adult was usually kindly... that children should aspire to be like their parents and this sort of thing. But actually, we well know that often parents are duds.
Yes.
And that children who showed initiative, who asserted themselves, they alienated themselves from society. These are books that she calls subversive.
Mm.
And she liked subversive books. She considered Alice in Wonderland a subversive book, or The Wizard of Oz a subversive book, because here are little girls who do things that little girls at that time weren't supposed to do.
Mm.
She liked the rebelliousness of of children in these books and the authors who had the courage to express it. But I guess it's still being done. I mean, subversive books are still being written. These are breakthrough. All the Judy Blume books are subversive books.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think when I'm talking about values and looking for values in books, what I'm looking for are books that help build self-esteem, independence, that build creativity of thought. All of those things can be quite subversive. If you tell a child, don't believe everything you're told, that can be a subversive message. I think that you can encourage those things in children without crossing the line of good taste. But I would tend to agree. I think that there are that it's parents may feel that if they give a book to a child called "Don't Lie, Don't Cheat, Don't Steal," that the child is going to absorb this message, which I think is nonsense. I think that to engage a child in the reading process so they begin to absorb what they can from the book, the child has to be turned on by the message of the book itself. You know, there has to be that kind of spark, that kind of connection to the book. Otherwise, they're not going to absorb anything. And I think that the books that help to build the positive traits that parents, I hope all parents want the children to have, of creativity, of independence, are there in the best books.
Well, children's literature appears to be thriving in spite of all of the competition from videos and all of these cable television and Sony Walkman and this sort of thing.
Mm.
It still seems to be doing pretty well. That's my perception, at least.
Yes, it really hasn't been hurt. I mean, I think people who say that oh, it's the end of the printed word and so on are in my view, alarmists. Children today have more choices than ever before for entertainment, for information, as do their parents. But books remain a vital source of information of growing. I think that everyone would agree that reading, that literacy, is an important, a crucial skill to build. I mean, I don't know what I would do if I couldn't read. I truly don't.
I'd be out of a job.
So would I.
That's your question. Do you have children?
I'm not so blessed as of yet, unfortunately, although I feel like I do. I have nephews galore, all of whom are members of Children's Book of the Month Club.
Would you, if you have children, would you establish a reading list for them? How would you channel their reading interest, if you would channel it at all?
I don't know that I would. I think that the best thing that a parent can do is to provide lots of books for the child to choose between. If you provide the books and you talk about books, then I think that to me is the kind of thing that you can do to instill a love of reading. I think that to give a list to a child is which is what my mother did for me, is going to be ignored. I think that if you talk about books, if you say, gee, you know, I remember reading Farewell to Arms and I was so moved by something, you can share anything with a child along those lines, and the child will get from you a love of reading. And that is going to do more good than any amount of book lists and such.
Well, when I was 13, 14, 15, my mother was always on my back. She said, Don, all you do is read science fiction. All you read. Your mind is so narrow. Actually, it was a wonderful bridge from children's books to adult books. I read Ray Bradbury, for example, who was an extremely adult science fiction writer. And I still look back... I don't read science fiction now to any degree, but I look back nostalgically at my science fiction collection, which is still intact in the storage room in Upper Manhattan. Boy, if I had kids, I would say, read anything you want.
Yes.
Go to my library, get any, I don't care how dirty it is, just read it. I mean, yes. At least you're reading.
Yes, exactly. I feel the same way. My mom was the same with me about horror novels and horror literature, which is, you know... an awful lot like science fiction in the
way.
I
should have to hide my comic book edition of Tales from the Crypt.
yes, me too.
I loved it when the hand came out of the earth, you know.
Oh, exactly.
Wonderful.
Fantastic
wonderful
stuff. Fantastic stuff. And, you know, I mean, look how we turned out, Don. I mean, men of great moral fiber. And
well, speak for yourself. Well, it was great talking to you. I like better than... talking about books, children's books, adult books. It's a wonderful thing to talk about. I understand that you've had some experience as a stand-up comedian. Do you use any of your book experience in your act?
No. The book pardon me. I have lots of chums who are still in the field and are all making more money than I am. A couple of them just had their own sitcoms, actually, and wasn't too long lived. I don't guess. A guy named Lenny Clark. Maybe it was on CBS. I don't recall. A fellow named Steve Wright and a woman named Paula Poundstone. So I have a lot of friends that are still doing it, and I talk to them, and then they take my material and they do it. So if you ever hear any comedian telling jokes about books or book clubs, maybe I wrote it. I don't know.
Well, being a stand-up comedian would be so scary. I mean, I couldn't do it. I'd be so petrified.
You'd love it. No. I mean, no?
No.
Well, I mean,
I'm terrible in front of an audience anyway. If I have to make a speech or something, I always write it out.
Yes, I know the feeling.
You know, I'm just terrible at ad-libbing things, and I would be petrified trying to be funny, too.
I always just, I tried to forget that. I tried to just always say that I'm going to be interesting, and I hope it's going to be funny. But if it's not, at least I hope it's interesting, you know. But to get up and just try to do, you know, talk as honestly as you could about whatever was on your mind, and hope that at least people will sort of nod and smile occasionally, if not guffaw.
Well, David Allender, look at it like this. You have a much bigger audience. They're kids, but it's a bigger audience than you probably had in a stand-up comedian club, right?
That's true. That's true. I do think of it that way.
Sounds like a wonderful job.
Yes, it is.
Well, it's great talking to you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don. Thanks very much.